I thank you, Rich. K2KMB, K2RIW. What crazy timing. A couple of minutes before the beginning of your technet, my power came back on after being off for 5 1/2 hours. This is K2 Romeo, India, Whiskey. My name is Dick. And at this time, with some power difficulties, looks like we're going to have a technet tonight. The usual reason you guys know is the education. The curious amateurs gather to be A2RYY. Joe has already signed in. Gather here at this time to trade information with each other. And something like 8 or 9 major trees fell down in my neighborhood of Dix Hills, and many of them hit power lines. So they weren't sure they're going to be able to restore power. Okay, we're going to take check-ins at this time. People who do have a comment or a question for the TechNet, please give me your call letters and name. A typical fan in would sign like this, WS2N, Paul, and yes. So give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes if you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW, listening.
Any Toyotic for the comments to the net.
Okay, we've got Joe, we've got Rich. The next person to sign in, please give me your call letters and name right now, K2RIW.
QRLW, Bob.
And WS2N, you want to know how many customers are out right now, Dick? Now that you got your power back on?
Okay, we got Bob, RLW, and Paul. Tell me about how many customers. Go ahead, Paul.
37,735 is still out. I have the PSE&G website up. So it's a lot of people are, especially around here, I have a map too, especially around your area, Dick.
So 37,000 are out. Wow. And I'm one of the high priority people that they turned on early. I'm dreaming a little bit. Okay, we got Joe, we got Rich, we got Bob. Rob, T2RLW, I think it is. Anyone else to check in? Because you do have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and your name right now. T2RIW, listening.
M2MOC, Mike, no question or comment.
Okay, MLC, Mike, with no question or comment, but maybe you'll think of one. One last call. Anyone who's got a question or a comment for the net, please give me your call letters and name right now.
Correction on the calls, MOC, Mike Oscar Charlie.
We got Mike Oscar Charlie. Very fine. Can't even read my writing. What was your name?
Mike.
I got it, Mike. All right, one last call. Anyone with a question or a comment for the net, please give me your call letters and your name right now. K2RIW, listening.
Okay. Huntington, correct?
You said Huntington. Dix Hills is a section of Huntington. Is that what you're asking, Paul?
Oh, okay, I'm showing Huntington is 13,785. So, you know, it's a big area. A big outage by you.
Yeah, I was seeing the, let's see now. It's not Con Ed. It's the PSE&G, I guess. I've been seeing their trucks going up and down my street. They're trying to figure out the... Which are the down power lines, which are arcing and sparking, are they going to fix first? Okay, Joe's got a juicy question for us tonight, he claims. So let's see what Joe's got to say. And I believe, yeah, I'm hearing the, I'm hoping that the East Coast, here we go, the 147-375 repeater, the repeater out there in the eastern end of Long Island. I wonder if it's working. Unfortunately, when Joe talks, sometimes his voice doesn't come out of that other repeater and doesn't come out of the Echo Link or the IRLP, one or the other. So we may have to repeat what you're saying, Joe. to B2LYY, K2LIW in the tech net.
And Y2H.
Go right ahead, Lou.
Yeah, Sylvan is working. Joe is using unconventional means to get in, so he's not guaranteed full coverage.
That I know, and I thank you, Lou. So, thank you for all the stuff that you're doing out there. Joe, to B2LYY, go right ahead with your juicy question. K2LIW listening.
Desirable.
I hear you. And now you're much louder on 85 and you're not coming out of 375.
I'm well aware of that. I know exactly what I'm doing. Okay. Have you got your calculator handy? I know.
Calculator's in my hand.
146.250 times 4.
Is 585.
Does that number sound a little familiar to you?
Okay. What do you know of that's popular on 585? Go right ahead.
Well, from 584 to 590 is RF channel 2. Now, when I transmit on high band, my radio whacks out my converter. I just happened to stumble on that, not even thinking about the relationship. So here's the question. I have RF taps, which are capacitively coupled, and they change the attenuation across the frequency band, which is sort of undesirable. Sometimes it is, but for my particular application, it's not desirable. If I went out and purchased a low-pass filter and put it after this radio to measure the proper performance of that filter without feeding the power into my service monitor, which I don't want to do, and to be able to use a spectrum analyzer and get an idea, an accurate idea if that filter is actually working, knowing before and after I put the filter in, to measure the fourth harmonic level of energy, is there anything that you know of that is resistive coupled that you can attach to an RF line that would give me a drop of 50 decibels and would have a frequency span from, say, 10 megs up to at least 500 or more? Any ideas?
Okay. In theory, if you got enough money, you can buy a zillion dBs of attenuator, resistive attenuator, 50 ohms in and 50 ohms output. You've got a tapping device, which is capacitively coupled, you're absolutely right, and therefore it favors the higher frequencies. And if it's pure capacitive coupling, four times the frequency would be 12 decibels stronger signal for the high frequency versus the low frequency, the 4-to-1 ratio, 12 dB. But as long as you've got the coupling down to give you, let me pick a number, 50 dB of coupling, and the high signal is being favored by 12 dB, that's not a showstopper. It's still possible to use that coupler. But with a big enough paycheck, you can certainly buy a resistive attenuator that's flat out to 18 gigahertz that has any number of decibels you want, if you're willing to pay for it. To B2LYY, K2LIW.
Right. Well, that coupler I use, I actually have two of them. One is UHF, one is N female and male. PL59, SO239. That one's got about 40 dB of coupling on lower frequencies, like 6 meters. But the other coupler, the N coupler, the curve goes crazy. It goes out about 90 decibels a drop on 6 meters, so it's not flat at all. So I have it set for 50 dB a drop at 500 megahertz, goes down to about 65 or so on VHF and about 90 on 52 megahertz. So it's a little hard. I know it's hard to predict if I was looking for harmonic energy. So you think the only thing I can do, the only way around this really, is I have to buy an expensive attenuator, read the transmitter to attenuator and look at the actual output plus harmonics that way, correct?
I didn't say that's the only way. I'm just saying that's the traditional way. Now, if you're willing to remove the capacitive coupling device and with a miniature semi-rigid coax cable, you make an inductive loop. The inductive loop will be set up in the plane of the center conductor of the main straight through line on your coupler. The inductive loop will not be rising 6 dB per octave, it'll be falling 6 dB per octave. Let me think about that. Capacitive rises, inductive, yes, inductive is going to fall. Or just be flat. But you won't get anywhere near as much rise with an inductive coupling loop. So you could make an inductive coupling loop in there, Joe, and you would not have that 12 dB rise. It's either going to be flat or it's going to be a fall off of 12 dB. We'll have to study that a little bit more. W2LYY, K2LYW in the TechNet.
Okay, well, I could borrow a power attenuator because I had somebody get one a long time ago for their power meter, and the expensive part was about, I think, a 30 dB coupler, 30 dB attenuator with a 10 dB precision paid after that, so you could feed that into a Enritsu power sensor head without blowing it up. I mean, that's a possibility. I know the guy fairly well, but I was thinking of trying to, you know, actually own something myself, but there's no way to actually do it by making any kind of resistor network that would have low inductance where it would be, you know, fairly predictable as far as its output level. So I can't do it without actually attenuating the power through some sort of power attenuation resistor network, correct?
There are people who are very skilled with miniature capacitors, and they do a watchmaker type work. As long as the components are small enough, you could lay out a resistive attenuator that does the job. Now, will it be able to absorb the full power of your transmitter is another thing to worry about altogether. Also, you could put a low-pass filter in the system. You could put a low-pass filter in the system is another approach, Joe. So inductive coupling would certainly help. It would not be favoring the higher frequencies. A resistive network that could be homebrewed, which would be a little bit unflat, but it would do the job. Or, what was my third choice? Yes, a low-pass filter. A low-pass filter for that frequency region, guarantee they exist. You know, a 200 megacycle low-pass filter would be a beautiful thing that probably exists on eBay. I remember buying something like that once, and I seem to remember I had to pay $20 for it. W2LYY, K2LYW. Of course, it won't be available at the exact time you want it. That's Murphy's Law. Over to you, Joe.
Well, I know that getting the filter is the second part of the problem. That solved the initial problem with my radio, being able to transmit at certain times. If I'm, you know, watching something, it's going to tend to not blank out the converter as easy because I'm transmitting off a discone antenna, which is at the top of my television antenna. It's only spaced about maybe 10 foot above it, so to speak. So it does a pretty good job of knocking out the converter on not only that channel, but other channels from simple overload. But that was a direct relationship by four times. I don't know why this radio is putting out that kind of energy at four times the frequency if it's a commercial radio, but I guess it's doing enough to make the converter unhappy as it gets amplified and fed back to the converter. Converter's actually the thing that gets overloaded. So getting the harmonic filter is not a problem. I haven't even tried looking for one, but I'm sure I could find one relatively cheap, but not in that high of demand. So I guess the power attenuator seems to be the only way of actually correctly doing this, because I like to have something that's predictable, where it's flat from, you know, very low frequency up to, you know, if it was up to a gig, that'd be fine. So, okay, you sort of answered my question. I sort of had an idea I would have to go in that direction, but I wasn't quite sure. I wasn't sure if there's another way of making up some sort of resistive elements put together to be able to do that. These low power, some of these low power pads I have, I have a whole collection of those, different values and so forth, but they're only like, five watts a piece, so they're going to, the first one would get actually destroyed if I try putting transmitting power into it, so I have to, you know, do something else there. But okay, so an interesting question to be entertained anyway.
Yeah, the inductive pickup, as opposed to the capacitive coupling, that still is usable, Joe. If you are running the straight-through line of your coupling device into a dummy load, which you've already got, and if you're using an inductive pickup, the inductive pickup falls off versus distance in wavelengths, okay? Let's assume that your little pickup coil is spaced, let me pick a number, 3/8 of an inch away from the center conductor of the coupling device, 3/8 of an inch. And that represents a very small number of wavelengths at 146 megacycles, but it represents a bigger number of wavelengths at 585 megacycles. So it's going to have a fall off at higher frequencies, a somewhat predictable fall off at higher frequencies. So if you were using the output by way of the coupler, you could attenuate the higher frequencies. You could attenuate the 40 dB on the 146 and maybe 52 dB on the 580 megacycles, Joe. So I wouldn't completely abandon that approach. That is another approach. W-A-2-L-Y-Y, T-2-L-A-W.
Yeah, with that coupler I have, the one with the capacitive coupler, especially the end-to-end, that's a pre-made device. I don't really want to wreck that in any way because, you know, it has some pretty good uses, even though the, you know, the curve is kind of like, doesn't favor what I want to do all the time. I don't want to really take it apart and try to wreck it. That sliding portion that's capacitively coupled actually can go down to about 20 decibels. I've already tried it. It can go down about 20, 20 one way, maybe up to 60 or 70 the other way, but pull all the way out at one particular frequency, like 500 megahertz. Okay, so at least I have some ideas of what I have to sort of maybe look for to make this happen correctly. Thanks for the input, W-H-Y-Y. Next guy.
You don't have to really change your device, Joe. Right now, you go from 20 dB to 40 dB by just changing the depth of that, let's call it a trombone, the sliding piston-like device with the capacitive coupling. You can slide that assembly out, lay it aside, build another sliding assembly, which has got a loop on the end instead of a capacitor probe, and slide it in. So you're not damaging your unit if you made a capacitive coupler, an inductive coupling loop. You're just making a brand new slide-in trombone device, Joe, and leave your current device alone. Or another approach is you could make a miniature coupling loop that you plug into the end of your current trombone. It's something that you can put on and take off when you want to. It takes the center conductor of your current capacitor probe, puts it into a loop, which then gets grounded, and you slide that loop cap device on the end of your current trombone. So again, there's at least two ways you can get what you desire without changing in any way your current piece of hardware. To be 2LYY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Oh, okay, as you're talking, I was thinking about something else, because inside the service monitor itself, and the reason I want to put power to that thing, because I've had a bad failure on one of mine. I have two of them. And one of them had a bad failure a couple of years ago where the switching really did not switch, where it normally takes the power and it, as it senses RF, it puts the power from the TR port into a 50 ohm load internally. That can handle 50 watts continuous, 100 watts intermittent, instead of putting it into the attenuator. One time the transfer relay did not switch, and I put about 100 watts into the back end of the attenuator, which is about $1,800. I was very that that happened. But they do have a coupling device within that same unit that comes off the power termination module
and goes back to the spectrum analyzer, because you can always look at your spectrum analyzer when you put power into the TR terminal. Maybe I should look and see what kind of parts they have for layout. Maybe something I could build something similar to that. I didn't even think about that before, and it's a lot cheaper than buying a power terminating resistor.
Yep, copy that thing, Joe. Somebody's already solved the problem, and you're a crafty enough guy, I guarantee you'll find a way of doing that. And you'll be telling us about that next week. Okay, with your permission, I'm going to go over to the next guy. W2RYY for final comment, K2RIW.
As I said, now you can hand over the next guy. This one's pretty well wrung out for right now.
That's pleasure. Okay, we're going to go over to Rich and to EO. And Rich is going to be careful not to say anything political or social. Be careful with the kind of material you discuss, Rich. Sometimes people get unhappy with that. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet. Make sure it's not too personal.
No, Dick, not at all. Some general comments. I don't know why you're saying that to me. You really shouldn't be. First of all, it's now called National Grid, not PSE&G. They keep selling it off. Two things. First of all, one thing which bears repeating, and I'm going to bring it up on the computer net for a second time, too. There's software out there, or supposed software. It's called Advanced System Optimizer Pro. It's supposed to take out and clean up your Windows. It's a scam. They take your money, but they never send you a license key. It's a large scam. When you call them, they have a California number, but you get transferred to India. Everybody there has an Indian accent. And they also have a guy in Spain, or at least he says he's in Spain, picking up at nighttime. It's a total scam. I got scammed for about $100. Fortunately, my bank made good. So I'm putting in a warning. Don't go near it. It's called, again, Advanced System Optimizer Pro. Stay away. The other thing, Dick, I wanted to bring up, I want the digital modes. A lot of people don't know how to get started.
W2RYY, can I make a comment?
Yes, you can.
Rich, N2EO, there are many, many things you can find on the internet. Why don't you spend the money and put a reputable antivirus software in your computer? There are different makes, different names, and so forth. Norton, McAfee, and I'll tell you what I use. I use ESET, E-S-E-T. They run about $90 for a 2-year subscription. They're excellent. So why don't you stick with something like a name brand, put it in your computer, and if you have a problem with your computer, you can scan it and find something, and it'll take it out for you. Because sometimes these other things you find on the internet are absolutely trouble. Trouble, trouble.
I agree with you, Joe. I have McAfee. By the way, every time he pronounces it McAfee, that's wrong. It's McAfee. Because it's M-C, not M-A-C-A-F-E-E. Anyway, right after the scam, I bought it. I have it now. So thank you. And Dick, what I wanted to say was a lot of people don't know how to get started in the digital modes. Let me let it reset. Okay, some time ago, for not a lot of money, I purchased from a company called West Mountain Radio. West Mountain Radio. It's an interface. It's called the Rig Blaster Advantage. Rig Blaster Advantage. You plug the mic into it, you plug that in, the Rig Blaster, into the radio, and then you hook up two cables. One from his, you plug the speaker into this device, and then a cable from the device back to the speaker output. And by the way, that cable does not come with it. You have to make it. A short piece of speaker wire and two plugs. On my case, the jacks, the plugs are, what do you call, the little 3/16-inch tipping ring. That's what I made, just about 8 inches long. That's all. There's no effect on the radio when you're on voice. The device is powered from the computer. You plug it into your computer. And the software, there's a lot of shareware. I have one piece of software I run slow scan television on. It's called MMSSTV. Another program comes out of the Ukraine. It's called MixW. MIXW. I purchased that a long time ago, so I'm still able to use it. The license for it is forever. I forget what I paid for it. It comes out of the Ukraine. It's got virtually every digital mode known to man in there, and they keep updating it. So I recommend both. N2EO, back to that. I hope I've been helpful to people.
Very fine, Rich. That sounds like some good-sounding information. West Mountain Radio is an organization run by two well-known ham radio operators, and that's part of the reason why I think a lot of people like their stuff. So sounds like you were very happy with it. Let's see if anyone has any further questions for you on any of the items that you just mentioned. Anybody any further questions or fill information for Rich? Give me your call letters right now. K2IW in the TechNet.
W-A-2-C-D-O.
W-A-2-C-D-O with a little bit of noise. K2IW. Go right ahead, Andy.
Okay, this is not referred to what Mitch just mentioned. I just want to just a mention to you if you want to. Stand by a second. Let me just change radios.
Hi, this is Ben. Sorry. Just Dick, when you get a chance, I can't stay. I got to leave. I'm just waiting for somebody. I just want to make a mention that was given to me via a text message. I just wanted to convey the information to you and see if you know anything about this. It's about the reallocation of the 2 meter band that according to what out of this conference we may lose. We may lose the 2 meter band. If you didn't hear anything about it, I can read a little bit of it to you and go from there. Just to let you know.
Yeah, I think you should read a little bit of that to us, Sir Rich. Of all the ham bands above 50 megacycles, 2 meters is by far the most popular. A zillion guys use it, particularly everybody who started off with a technician license. As such, with such a large number of people using it, and with all the backing of ARRL, I don't think an active conference would take that away from us. That's my belief, that we're not going to lose it, even though somebody's threatening it. But who is this great big ogre of an organization that thinks they're going to take 2 meters away, Andy? The B2CDL, K2IW.
Hi, and sorry to interrupt, Rich, because I can't stay on the air that long. I'm just waiting for somebody. There's a petition going around to have people sign, apparently, according to this. It says, I'll just read a little bit about it, and then you can just go from there. But you could Google it.
go to Google, and this comes from the ARRL, www.arrl.org, from the American Radio Relay League. This has to do with a World Radio Communication Conference, and according to their agenda, they're proposing to study a range of frequencies, including potentially reassigning the 144 to 146 megacycle band as a primary aeronautical mobile service allocation. In other words, they want to make it aeronautical instead of amateur. And out of the conference, it drew very little opposition to this, which means that most people were for it rather than against it. So they're proposing a petition now so we could save our 2-meter band. That's all. It goes on. It's quite in length. There's paragraphs attached to this, which I'm not going to just read the whole thing. So mainly just go to the ARRL website and look up World Radio Communication Conference 2023. I guess that's the date. This will be occurring in 2023. It's now 2019. So, for your information. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so we've got 3 and a fraction years before this disaster is going to happen, if it's going to happen. There's going to be a lot of discussions between now and then as to the pros and cons of taking this very popular band away from us amateurs. So, let's hope it doesn't take place. One last question I've got for you, Andy, and that is, how recent was this announcement? It sounds like it's an ARRL. Was this in the last couple of days in one of the newsletters from ARRL? Is that how recent this is, Andy? W2CDL, K2LIW.
I received this today, just a few hours ago, from one of my fellow amateur radio operators, who then received it himself, and he forwarded it to me. So this apparently just came out of this conference. I don't know exactly when this conference occurred, but as I said, you know, if you read it, it's quite in length, and it'll give you all the details about what happened, what went on, and who's opposing it and who's for it. So this I got today, just this afternoon.
Okay, I thank you for bringing that to our attention. Let's see if anyone on frequency wants to ask you any further questions about this this terrible possible situation. Anybody want to ask Andy any further questions on this? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW and the TechNet listening.
K2HUC with a comment.
Let me just give one more piece of information because I'm just reading it down right now.
Okay, you first, and then pass it over to HUC. You got it, Andy.
This was out of a meeting that was held between June 17th and June 21st in Prague, the Czech Republic. And it was introduced by France, the proposal targeting the 144 to 146 meg band would be part of the broader consideration of spectrum allocated to the aeronautical mobile service. So this just occurred a few weeks ago, June 17th to 21st, as I'm reading it. I just got this, and I'm reading it now because I just got the text just a little while ago. All right, back to you, and I'll let everybody else come in. I'm going to sign out because I gotta leave. W2CDL. Thanks, Dick.
Okay, KD2HUC, go right ahead, Steve, with your question or comment. You got it, Steve.
I did an article about this about a week ago, and it was, Andy actually touched on it just before he left. It wasn't originating out of this country, according to what I read, and the reason they're targeting it is not, you know, it has nothing to do with how popular the band is, but it's kind of consistent worldwide. So they want to target something that's consistent, you know, around all the different ITU regions. So that's why they're looking at this particular band. It has nothing to do with, you know, how much it's used or whatnot. So if there's a petition, by all means, send it to all the LIMARC members because we should definitely get on board. KD2HUC, back to net.
And Steve was going through the Eastern input, what do we call the Selden input, and you sound good through Selden. both the input and the and through the machine that way. Let's see if anybody's got any further questions for Steve. Give me your call letters right now if you do. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay. And Andy, I guess you've completely signed out, and no further comments from Andy, but I'll pass it over to him just to be sure. To B2CDL, K2RIW. Go ahead, Andy. And he did say he had to leave. Okay. Now, all of that was an interruption on the tail end of what Rich was giving us, N2EO. Let's make sure that Rich got a chance to say everything he wanted to say. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Oh, okay, Dick. Well, this proposal, I have to say, is awful. We all know that. I don't have any more to say. The only thing I want to stress, if you buy a Rig Blaster Pro, the cable that goes between the Rig Blaster Pro and the speaker output of the radio is not included. They should include it, but they don't. You have to make it out of a small piece of speaker wire or any conductor with dual conductor and two jacks, rather two plugs on each end. It only has to be about 8 inches long or 10 inches long. And take four of the tiny jacks, plugs, and jacks, 3/16 inch.
So if I understand you correctly, Rich, you made your own set of jacks to do the coupling, plug in and unplug, and that fed the speakers, and I think you're saying that all worked out pretty well for you. Is that true, Rich, in 2EO, K2LAW?
Yes, it worked out excellently. Now, like I said, there's a lot of shareware software that you don't have to buy. The one I bought comes out of the Ukraine. I don't remember the price. It's a lifetime license. And I don't remember. It's called MIXW. It's got every digital mode known to man, and they keep upgrading it. New versions.
Now, I think you're talking about a West Mountain Radio product that has this software built into it. Is that true, Rich, or am I mixing things up here? Over to you, Rich.
No, you're mixing it up. The West Mountain Radio Rig Blaster is a dumb interface. You need the software on your computer. You can download it.
Okay, so you put that into your computer. And how expensive was that software, Rich?
Like I say, I really don't remember. I bought it many years ago. It's a lifetime license. They keep coming up with new versions. They keep updating it. And they do not charge you for that. Once you have the license, it's for life.
Okay, let's see if anybody has any further questions for Rich before we go to the next person. So if you've got any further questions for N2EO, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is AC2GS. MIXW4 goes for about $90 these days.
And from what you can tell, Roy, I think would you say that's a good buy and a reliable source? AC2GS, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick. It's a well-designed and updated software, so if you want to spend money, it's money well spent. There are free software. There's a whole group of things that start with FL Digi that are freeware. I have the entire slew of those programs as well, And they serve my purpose and don't cost me anything. And there's also another USB soundboard interface available in addition to Rig Blaster. It's a company called, it's a product called SignalLink that offers different cables and configurations for different radios.
Okay, sounds good. Let's see if Rich has any final comments. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. The signal link is very good, but the problem is here, maybe other people don't have the problem. It goes, it connects from the signal link to a DIN plug. The DIN plug is a 13-pin DIN plug, very special, but I'm using that port now, so I can't plug a signal link into it. Unless I make an adapter.
Roy, is that adapter a difficult item? AC2GS, K2RIW.
Dick, I'm not quite sure what he's alluding to. My interface to my radios is via an RG14 plug that then splays out to the particular types of connectors that my radio has. So I'm not quite sure. I think he's alluding to the connector on his radio, not the one that sits on the signal link.
Over to you for a comment on that one, Rich.
Well, I was under the impression it goes to the 13-pin bin only, but maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know. It might have been an older model you looked at or confused with a different model. This one, as I said, just has some audio input-output 3/8 plugs and a RJ14 connector that pretty much connects the radio to it.
I don't know what an RJ14 is, Dick. I don't know.
Well, Roy's going to give us a couple of words. What does an RJ14 look like, Roy?
It looks like an Ethernet connector.
Sounds good. Okay. I thank you, Rich, for all the information you've given us. We're now going to go over to the next person, Bob. K2 Romeo Lima Whiskey. Set of call letters that are fairly similar to mine, Romeo India Whiskey. K2 Romeo Lima Whiskey. You got it, Bob. K2RIW. Is it Bob or Rob? You got it, sir. One more call. K2 Romeo Lima Whiskey. It's your turn, sir. K2RIW in the tech net. Do you have a question or a comment for us? Okay. Is there anyone else on frequency that has a question or a comment for the TechNet? Please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening. Okay, looks like you're going to have some extra time tonight for your puzzles and questions and everything else on the science talk and the mailbag. So, Dr. Roy, AC2GS, you're up at bat. K2RIW, go ahead, Dr. Roy.
Okay, very good, Dick. Always a pleasure to be here, and pleasure to do this stuff. Tonight we have two mailbag questions from the same person. One was given to me in email yesterday and one today. So I'll read you his first email question, and then after you answer it, I guess we can go to the next one. He was writing in regard to your description about how modulated RF signals reflect back and forth as many as 10 times while being partially radiated into the near field by an antenna. writes, how can this occur with an analog signal like a simple radio transmission? Since the signal is always present, or let's say always coming down the cable into the antenna constantly, during the broadcasting, of course, the mic is pressed. What happens to the new signal entering the antenna if the last signal is busy bouncing around in there? And what happens to the part of the signal that's held up? Do we get a traffic jam on the cable? And if some of the signal radiates out on the first pass, and then some more gets out the second pass, and then the third pass, don't we end up with the signal getting out in pieces instead of all in one? So that's his first question.
And he's using good-sounding logic. I don't blame him for saying the words he's saying. But now let's actually look at the, there's two factors here. Even though you've got 10 bounces, say, for instance, we're sending a signal down a 2-meter dipole. A 2-meter dipole is a half-wave dipole would be roughly 38 inches tip to tip. Each side is 19 inches long. 19 inches is very close to 1.5 feet. So therefore, the amount of time it takes for the signal to travel down the wire, since the RF energy travels at the speed of light at 1 nanosecond per foot. I'm rounding up the numbers a little bit, but it's close enough. 1 nanosecond per foot is the speed of light. So 1.5 feet one way is 1.5 nanoseconds. 1.5 billionths of a second. If you're making 10 bounces before the signal disappears, 10 bounces out of 1.5 nanoseconds is 15 nanoseconds. 15 billionths of a second. 0.015 microseconds. And I could give you two, a hell of a lot more zeros to do it in milliseconds and so on. So, although the signal is bouncing there for that length of bounces, because the amount of timing of each bounce is so small, you would never know the difference. Nobody is sending data that fast. If you're sending data at 10 gigabits per second, you might run into a little bit of a problem of the trailing edge of one of the bits of the data has not had a chance to survive all of the bounces, if you know what I mean. And you might try to send nobody in his right mind would try to send a 10 gigabit signal on 144 megacycles. Maybe on the 100 gigacycle band, yes. On the 0.1 gigacycle band, no way. You don't get those kind of bandwidths. So the timing that we're worrying about, really, when you get down to the specifics, is not a real problem. Now, let me give you another couple of words that'll give you a little bit more confidence about this bouncing situation. Let me drop. I will admit, there is no book, no lecture I know of, where you can find this bouncing phenomena that I'm telling you about. This is my way of explaining what I think is going on. We all would like to believe that signal we send out of our transmitter down the transmission line, that when it hits the antenna, the signal travels down the wire of the antenna and jumps into space. We'd like to believe that. If that was true, then the length of the wire wouldn't matter. You could take that half-wave dipole, 38 inches long on 2 meters, make it longer or shorter, and it would radiate a little bit better or a little bit less, but you'd have no real other effect. You actually run an experiment where you take 38 inches of half-wave dipole on 2 meters and make it a little bit longer, a little bit shorter, by an inch or two, you will see a huge change in the standing wave ratio. You make it longer, it becomes inductive. You make it shorter, it becomes capacitive real fast. That's giving you a strong clue that when the antenna is the right length and all of those bounces are in phase with each other, they're all in step, they're all coherent with each other, you don't sense any inductive reactance or capacitive reactance. But as long as you make the wire a little bit longer, it takes a little bit longer in time for the signal to go down there, and by the time 10 bounces has happened before the signal is finally radiated, some of those bounces are now being delayed by that extra length, and therefore you see an inductive reactance on the antenna. So the fact that the reactance builds up so fast gives you a strong hint. Another strong hint is that you can use the right kind of laboratory instrumentation. Let me drop. You can measure the real rise time of the signal you're injecting into the antenna. You can use a real fast pulsing device, put a square wave amplitude versus time pulse of RF energy into that antenna. And now, with a remote receiving device, you measure the leading edge and you watch the signal build up. It takes a number of cycles for that signal to build up. Or when you abruptly stop the signal, it takes quite a number of signals for the signal on the antenna to attenuate. The fact that the antenna has a rise time and a fall time tells you it's got a Q of something like 10. The fact, that's another piece of information that there really is inductance going. There is stored energy. The antenna itself, there's a lot of ways you can confirm that a half-wave dipole of conventional construction has a Q. Q is something that you, it's a quality you measure, which is a function of bandwidth, it's a function of rise time, a function of fall time, a function of stored energy per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. All of those definitions are Q. And so the fact that it's got stored energy, the fact that it's got a finite rise time, a finite fall time, a finite bandwidth, that's also center frequency divided by bandwidth is another definition of Q. The fact that the antenna has a bandwidth that falls off pretty fast when you go higher and lower in frequency, or it falls off pretty fast in standing wave ratio when you make it longer or shorter. All of these are giving you hints that the signal is really bouncing back and forth. And so, and another way of knowing that is that if you read the right book, that dipole is called a standing wave structure. Yes, a rhombic antenna, which is multiple wavelengths long with a terminating resistor at the end, that's called a traveling wave antenna. But a dipole antenna is one of the many kinds of antenna that's called a standing wave structure. Therefore, you know, how do you get a standing wave? Signals are bouncing. So, as I said, I don't blame you for feeling uncomfortable with this bounce explanation. It's my way of explaining what I think is going on, and I'm giving you the pieces of evidence that support that. So before we go to the next section, I wonder if that makes sense to you, or if you'd like a little more explanation, or would you like to add some questions to this one, Roy? ACQGS. ACQGS. K2LIW. Go ahead, Roy.
No, Dick, you did a great job. I took the liberty of giving him my take. I mentioned the periodicity of 2 meters and the symbol rate required to have any effect on something like that. And I even mentioned the standing wave phenomena as part of it. So I've learned from you. So I agree with everything that you said.
Wow. If I keep paying you, will you keep saying things like that? Okay, Roy. Okay, I think you said that's the first half of this mailbag question. I think there's a second half. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
Yes, indeed. Chris has a second question. By the way, we're going to try and cajole Chris into going for his tech license so he can ask his questions on the air. I think that would be loads of fun because he writes some very interesting questions that I've had the opportunity to read, but I'd love to have him here so he could interact with everyone. So here's his second question that he gave me today. He says, I've always wanted to ask exactly what an antenna tuner is. He says, I understand the purpose and need for it, making an improper antenna, an incorrect length, etc., for a frequency match more closely. But he says, I don't understand what it is doing electronically to accomplish that.
Yeah, that's an extremely good question, a timely question, because, Roy, you and I can tune across the 20-meter band on many days of the week, and we'll find somebody giving his opinion about the uselessness, the uselessness, the non-useful characteristics of an antenna tuner. Okay, remember now with this, I'm going back to the bounce phenomena first. The signal we put on the antenna, we launch that signal with our transmission line at the beginning of a dipole-like structure, for instance, and that energy that we're putting onto that dipole bounces back and forth approximately 10 times before the majority of it gets radiated. It has to do that because radiation is hard. You've got to kick that signal in the tail 10 times in a row before it finally leaves the antenna. If that wasn't true, you could use any old length of wire. The signal would jump onto your wire and then jump into space. It doesn't do that. You've got to make sure that you you've got all of those bounces, co-phase, in step with each other in order for that radiation to take place. Okay? Let's see now. I'm all of a sudden lost my train of thought a little bit. Where am I going with this one? Give me two words as to the nature of his second question. All of a sudden, I've lost my train of thought. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, Dick. Basically, he wants to know how an antenna tuner does its magic. What is it that it does in order to correct the fact that you're dealing with a non-resonant antenna without it, and how it does its magic is basically what he's asking. How does the darn thing actually accomplish or what it sets out to do?
As you can tell, I completely forgot about the fact that I'm discussing antenna tuner. That's the magic word I needed. Okay, that antenna that you can make shorter or longer, in other words, you've got a restricted space in your backyard, you want to put up an 80-meter dipole, for instance, you need 137 or 135 feet to do that, and your yard is only 65 feet wide, can you still put a half-wave dipole in that backyard? Answer is absolutely yes. You put the right kind of a loading coil on it. You add inductors at the beginning of the dipole. You use zigzagging, you use helical winding, you use top hat capacitors at the end of the dipole. There's various things you can do to the antenna to electronically tune it. When I said the signal is going to bounce back and forth and you want it to stay in resonance, the antenna must be electronically resonant. It doesn't have to be what you think is mechanically resonant. If it's a simple dipole made out of a flat piece of wire with nothing fancy, yes. On 80 meters, you're going to make it 130 some odd feet long, or on 2 meters, you're going to make it 38 inches long. That's making resonance by way of pure mechanical straight-out piece of wire. You can make the wire considerably shorter by putting loading coils on it and by putting top hat capacitors on it. And you could also make it longer than 38 inches on 2 meters by putting capacitors on it. So by putting extra reactive devices on the antenna, you can force it to be electronically resonant. When you add the loading coil, for instance, the signal going down the loading coil takes extra time to go down the turns of that coil. And yet, it goes down the coil, and then it enters the wire, and by the time it gets to the tip of the wire, if you've done everything correctly, it now is actually a quarter wavelength in time. And when it bounces back, another quarter wavelength in time. So that each half of the dipole, each bounce, is a half wave of bounce, if you know what I mean, on each side. So you can make it electronically resonant, and you'll get 98% of the performance as if you had made it physically resonant. So what is an antenna tuner? An antenna tuner that's placed right at the antenna. Let me drop. It's a box full of components that's got inductors and capacitors that you can change. In other words, it's got a variable capacitor, it's got an inductor you can change the taps on. You can add that inductance or that capacitance right at the antenna by using a box full of components that's called antenna tuner. And you adjust the dials on the antenna tuner and the knobs on it correctly, and now you've established electronic resonance of that antenna. So whether you do it with a carefully chosen inductor for your antenna, it's a little bit too small, but now you've re-established electronic resonance by adding that inductor, or by putting this antenna tuner in there, it does the job. Now, that's if you put the antenna tuner right at the antenna. What happens if you put the antenna tuner in the shack? Okay, your transmission line, if it's high enough in quality, so that the signal flowing down it has a low enough insertion loss, you can still have the ability to put the antenna tuner in the shack without suffering too much of a disadvantage. Instead of the extra signal, and by the way, I should have also mentioned one other part to you, and that is, if the antenna is not properly resonant, if it's a little bit too long or a little bit too short, or if it's electronically tuned too high or too low in frequency, then that dipole is not going to give you a 72 ohm impedance. It's going to give you some other impedance, probably with a whole lot of inductive reactance or capacitor reactance. But because it's giving you some other impedance, as far as the transmission line is concerned, a transmission line, if it was a dipole and it was an ideal world, you'd like the transmission line to have 72 ohms of impedance. That means the signal, 72 ohms of resistive impedance in that dipole. Therefore, the signal flowing down the transmission line wouldn't know the difference between a 72 ohm dummy load or your particular dipole. In either case, the signal goes into that loading device, and all of the signal from the transmission line's point of view is thoroughly delivered, and none of it reflects back. If the antenna is anything but a 72 ohm pure resistor in my example, because you're using 72 ohm transmission line, and you could buy 72 ohm coax cable, by the way. And I'm choosing 72 ohms because that's the impedance you get from a ideal dipole that's constructed in the usual manner. If the dipole is, if the load on the end of your transmission is anything but a 72 ohm resistor in this example, then you're going to get a predictable amount of signal reflected back. The transmission line is trying to deliver that signal to that load. If the load doesn't have exactly the right resistive impedance, then a certain amount of that signal reflects back, doesn't get absorbed by the load. The load, you could say, rejects it right at the front door, sends it back. And once you know the calculations for standing wave ratio, you can calculate exactly what magnitude of voltage comes back.